Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Technology Report. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us today is Mark Montgomery, a retired United States Navy Rear Admiral who is now the Senior Director of the Center on Cyber and Technology Innovation at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He is also the Executive Director of the Cyber Solarium 2.0 Project. He is also a former Director of Indo-Pacific Command Operations and a Distinguished Surface Warrior in his own right. Mark, welcome back to the program. It's always an honor and pleasure having you on.
Thank you very much for having me, Vago.
A pleasure indeed. And before we get started, the Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. Mark, enormous amount of cyber news, and it's great again to have you back on for an update. Let's start with the recent operations by the Russians, which have been very aggressive. The FBI director last week warned of the pre-attack intelligence gathering that he thought the Russians were doing. And it now looks like the Sandworm unit or hackers associated with the Russian military have conducted operations against America's water supply, and the Russians are boasting about it. And this comes even after President Biden said that offensive cyber operations that target or damage American infrastructure would be causus belli, would be a reason that we would respond in a kinetic fashion, or not necessarily purely in cyber fashion, that we thought was a positive development. Walk us through the Russian attack, why they chose what they chose, and then we'll, what is it they accomplished before we get to how it is that we should be responding? Because it's a watershed move, I think, in many respects.
No pun intended, I'm sure. Yeah, so I think you're right to bring this up. Look, in general, we've been saying publicly for about 7 years that Russia and China, since about 2018, that Russia and China have been doing, putting malicious payloads inside critical infrastructure. And, I think in the very first report, we talked about electrical power and financial services, but, that's been expanded to include water, ports, rail systems, energy grids. So, they're both of our, near peer adversaries have been doing what you and I would traditionally call operational preparation environment, right? Preparing the battle space for future conflict. So what do I think this Sandworm thing is? I think the Russians are probing around water systems, seeing where their common vulnerabilities, and sometimes testing them, doing disruption. I mean, this was this area, this Texas town was, 5,000 people. And it was they didn't even lose really their water supply. It was just an overflowing system. But it showed that they could take control of it. There have been other water attacks. There have been other, insertions of malware in electrical power grids. And that's what we've come across. It seems to me that the Russians, like the Chinese in what's called the Volt Typhoon operations on the West Coast of the United States, in Guam and Hawaii, what they're doing is inserting, probing systems, inserting malicious payloads so that during a crisis or contingency, they can be enabled to either disrupt or degrade the performance of the national critical infrastructure. And that's important because our military mobility rides on our national critical infrastructure. It doesn't ride, we don't move tanks and supplies and equipment and personnel on military-only rail systems or military-only ports. We go through all that. So I think this is about what you and I would traditionally call operational preparation of the environment.
First, why dams, right? Dams appear to be something that are being favored. Just real quickly, explain to the audience why, if you were targeting anything, you would be so fascinated by dams
as a target. Dams are a great case. They're cousins of the water system, and why I describe their vulnerabilities. So first of all, there are about 90,000 dams in America. About 10,000 of them are considered high hazard, which means if you disrupt them or disable them or destroy their ability to operate, it could put human life at risk. So that's a lot of human life at risk, right? Now, why are they like this? Well, dams are generally operated, you know, by utilities, either privately owned or state and local owned utilities that do not run on large profit margins, much like the 50,000 water utilities. The 90,000 dams are operated, you know, by a private sector that does not, you know, have extra money. They're not like the Department of Defense. So when you say there's a, you know, you need to spend on cybersecurity, their idea is about how, you know, is to spend 4 or 5% of their IT budget on cybersecurity instead of the 10 to 12% they need to be spending. So that's the first problem. The second problem is the FERC, the Federal Energy Resilience Commission or Liability Commission, which is the sector risk management agency, the federal agency that's supposed to help the dam sector, is woefully underfunded. To support those 90,000 dams, they have four people, you know, in their kind of outreach, website management. And this is how EPA is for supporting water and a few, it's what we found out during Colonial in the support to the pipelines. I contrast this with like the Department of Energy itself with the energy grid, which has, you know, 100 people and a $100 million budget. So first problem, you have a private sector that's underinvested. Second problem, you have a federal government that's not optimized and resourced to be a good partner. And here's the third problem. We're having to rapidly modernize these systems, you know, and giving them a lot of automated IT and OT, the operational gear and the information gear, you know, is becoming highly, in order to become more automated, to become more efficient, they're doing this at a point when they don't have the right level of federal support. They don't have the right level of investment. So cybersecurity is not getting properly invested in. So that kind of perfect storm comes together in the dams. And Senator Wyden has done a great job emphasizing that.
Let me take you to what the response needs to look like, though, right? Even if it was a precursor, even if it was an exploratory attack, it was an interference with America's water network and infrastructure. Now, there is a lot of interpretation about what, you know, I mean, was it damage? Was it a test? Did it hurt anybody? Right? And maybe in a court of law, you can make the case that it didn't hurt anybody. I mean, but I mean, the Russians are kind of boasting and taking credit for it, right? I mean, they're doing a little bit of a victory lap. What is it that we need to be doing to more clearly telegraph, nice one, you think you're being clever, because we have done things in Russia that have proven problematic for the Russians, and we can only assume, right, their system is maybe somewhat more vulnerable than ours is, even if our system is very vulnerable, right?
So
how do we respond to this?
So I think there's two levels of response. The first is kind of the deterrence by denial response, the idea of making yourself more resilient. So we do need to make those investments. I talked about them earlier. It's about getting the private sector to invest, getting the government to be a better partner. We do need to make ourselves. And look, you need to assume penetration, right? And what that means is you need to be looking, assume they get through your firewalls and being investing in anomalous activity detection. You know, what's happening that shouldn't be happening? Why is Jim in that server when he should never be in that server? That kind of stuff. So first, we'll set that aside. That's the deterrence by denial. What you're very much referring to is the deterrence by punishment. In other words, saying to the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, the Iranians, those are the four big nation states that do this. And even kind of more broadly, the criminal actors who are doing ransomware, holding them accountable. And the way you do that is, first of all, you implied this, it's doing our own persistent engagement or defend forward operations where we find out where they're operating from and we destroy their cyber infrastructure, the ability, you know, the, where they launch their attacks from, where they develop their tools, you know, go destroy that. And I think secondly, we continue what I'm sure is a healthy operational preparation, our own operational preparation environment of their systems, and maybe expose one or two, you know, where we kind of feel the tools getting kind of old, it might be compromised. Show them, hey, we were inside your system and we're just going to turn this off. You can go find the malware we put in there. But, you know, you just need to know we were there. So as much as you're in us, we're in you. And then actually impose cost on the actors that that do this. And for the ransomware ones, it's destroy their systems and where you can do it, law enforcement action. Now, look, we're not going to be extraditing anyone from North Korea, Iran, China, or Russia. But if we can prevent them from moving, we can prevent them from having access to cash, you know, to Western reserves. You know, that's important stuff. So it is a mix of those things, but you're absolutely right. At some point, we have to say this is not acceptable.
Indeed. Now, we're finding also in the course of operations, whether they involve the Chinese or the Russians, and to a degree, the North Koreans, because they're back up to their ransomwareing tricks as well. And I will get to Iran in a minute as well, what magnificent sort of axis they make. Microsoft has been criticized, and indeed, U.S. government has filed a suit against the company, accusing it for poor security that's allowed adversaries access to U.S. Networks. Apparently, the Russians were in our networks actually not that long ago and made off with some pretty sensitive information. Good news is we seem to have detected it, right? So this wasn't one of these things where, 320 days ago they were in there and we just sort of stumbled upon it. What is the specific issue? Because, I'm not lawyering for Microsoft at all. I know that the company has been focused on this, and Brad Smith has done a terrific job explaining the stuff that the company has been doing. What are the specific issues? I mean, it is a foundational software on which, a company on which the entire global infrastructure depends, right? So, but walk us through what the specific issues are. What are the vulnerabilities that are being exploited? And what is it that needs to be done collectively in order to close them? Or is the answer, as long as you're trying to do this, you will have vulnerabilities in one form or another?
Well, that's a complex question. Let me start by saying, first of all, the Biden administration, very specifically, the Undersecretary of Policy over at Homeland Security, Rob Silvers, did a really good job setting up something called a Cyber Safety Review Board. That's the report that came out recently that caught your eye. That Cyber Safety Review Board had a pretty damning report on Microsoft's cybersecurity failings. Following, there were public revelations about Chinese hackers really leveraging compromised Microsoft systems, accessing the email accounts of senior cabinet members of Gina Raimondo prior to her trip to China. And the report doesn't mince words. It says the cyber attack was preventable, should have never happened, was the result of a cascade of security failures at Microsoft. But here's the thing I'd say. When an independent board of experts like the CSRB, sponsored by the government put it together, but it's an independent board, when they tell a company that its corporate culture deprioritizes cybersecurity, it's time for some self-reflection by Microsoft. But when that company plays a dominant role providing technology services to the U.S. government, critical infrastructure, tens of thousands of U.S. companies, the federal government needs to conduct some self-reflection as well. In other words, there's probably things we can do to assist Microsoft, but also to hold Microsoft to the right standards. And I won't pick on Microsoft here. I'll say across all the cloud service providers, we need to be able to set a level of standards. I mean, it's Chris Inglis, right? My fellow, the commissioner on the Cyberspace Land Commission, the inaugural national cyber director, he said it. We are closing in on needing regulation in these critical industries. And the cloud service is one of them where it is a critical infrastructure like electrical. In fact, Brad Smith said this in a very eloquent post, cloud is a critical infrastructure. And so we're probably at that point now where, having watched this, yes, we should hold Microsoft accountable. Yes, they made a lot of errors. But this also has to do with how we as a government and an economy deal with the cloud. It is everyone's going to it, migrating to it. We have to ensure the security is high there. It'd be nice if we could do it through, consensual standard setting between Microsoft, Google, Amazon, and Oracle, the big four players. But if we can't get to where we need to be very fast, then we're going to need to regulate it there. We're going to need to say, this is the floor of cybersecurity. You cannot offer products lower than this. You can't do things less than this. And by the way, if you're a critical infrastructure, a big bank or power company, you need to be at even a higher floor in the building. And you cannot have security below that. And so I think we're headed there, Bago. I don't know how many more, oh my goshes, have to happen before we land on just regulation full stop. But I think we're closing in on it.
And I'm sorry that I transposed the two. The more recent one was not a Russian one, right? SolarWinds came up in this context in its original form, which was Russian. And then we had the more recent Chinese breach. So I apologize for crossing my wires on that. I want to take you to another piece of sort of the broader ecosystem that's weak, right? I mean, time and again, we're finding we don't have the right kind of people on the government side. Maybe the culture is not right on the corporate side. You know, the case that you and a number of other folks have made, Admiral Mike Rogers makes that case. Tim Hawk is making that case about better partnership with industry and government to try to get to a better place. Economist had a terrific story about the internet, right? We think of it as a robust, structure that helps govern our lives and is an integral tool. And it turns out it's managed by, two guys in Kansas, right? Give us a sense about the XE Utils episode. Because I think some are tracking it and some understand the story. I think 60 Minutes did a piece on it, but then there are other people who might not be as familiar about what's happening and why it's so important and why that too is a call for doing something differently than the way that we're doing it now, because it was basically a person who spotted what would have been a pretty major breach. Anyway, walk us through what happened and why it's so important and what we have to do about it.
So what happened is about a month ago, it was discovered that a backdoor had been integrated into XE Utils, which is an open, an important piece of software that runs inside open source, Linux open source systems. And Linux is like the ultimate unregulated service, right? As you said, managed by a couple guys in Kentucky or Kansas. And what happened was that a open source contributor, his name happened, at least his ghost name was Jia Tan. And it may be that he's an individual. It may be that he's part of a criminal gang. And even more likely, it may be he's part of a nation state attempt. He socially engineered himself into a trustworthy position by doing alterations to the as an open source contributor, doing legitimate work. And then over time, he kind of muscled his way into being granted what's called repository maintainer authority. Basically, he was another guy in a at a farm in Kansas, with the keys to the kingdom. And he was then able to kind of obfuscate his efforts and install malicious code in the primary XE Utils code database, right? Or code. So that's a big deal. That doesn't affect like 10,000 computers or 50,000 computers. This is millions and millions of operators would have had this code with malicious payload in it. And so and it was discovered by a volunteer member of the same kind of open source group. And this is very dangerous, right? This is completely unregulated. But pervasive software. And, I've been talking about open source for a while. There's a whole open source thing called RISC-V, where it's how we do, it's the open source of semiconductors. And the Chinese have really taken advantage of U.S. stealing U.S. intellectual property and that, really hoarding U.S. intellectual property and that. So open source has its challenges. But what this really exposed was the vulnerability we have now that since Linux is just so pervasive in systems, 80%+ of phones are running some sort of Linux, either as a primary or a supporting software. We are very vulnerable to this. It's unregulated, and we're going to have to take a hard look at, to what degree is it running inside military systems? What degree is it running inside, vital national critical infrastructures? The answer to the first one is going to be somewhat. The military systems, and the answer to the national critical infrastructure is going to be a lot. And we're going to have to figure out if we can accept that risk.
Reminds me of the Windows discussion, right? I mean, we can, whether it was on warships or anything else, this was your surface warfare generation. And then all of a sudden, China's not that big of a problem. And then it was like, oh, wow, wait a minute, China is a big problem. And the ships are running on Windows NT and stuff like that. And it's like, okay, well, what are some of the things we have to do to better protect ourselves, right? I mean, ultimately, every organization thinks that it might have some clever way of mitigating its risk, or the adoption of commercial system constitutes a mitigation of risk when you're just kind of opening up an attack surface, right? So it's fascinating.
You remind me, I should have said, I'm actually supporting a congressional committee that's looking at an issue like this. And what we're doing is illuminating the supply chain of different weapon systems. And Vago, it's jaw dropping. Once you get to a secondary or tertiary provider of software or hardware, the degree to which Chinese systems are all over, you know, whether you mentioned Aegis warships, but warships, aircraft, command and control networks. Because you're right, in 1990s and 2000s, when we were making decisions, cost mattered more than whether China was a security problem. And maybe we didn't even clearly understand then the security problem they would become. And we are absolutely relying in a way that would I think most of us would describe as unacceptable today, but it's a fact in being.
You know, the whole question of S-bombs, software bill of origin, and H-bombs, hardware bills of origin. You know, I mean, you know, there are some people who are like, oh my God, you know, it's too big of a problem. We just have to accept it unless you recognize you could have, right? I mean, the number of chip washing that happens or software washing that makes it into critical systems, somebody got that from an open source software directory that could have been planted there specifically because it's a perfect solution to a problem. Somebody grabbed it, incorporated it, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, as the story goes, fed it into a system, it works. And, you know, well, where did that come from? Just like hardware, the fact that, you know, Chinese chips have made it into a sub component that then, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, might have a parts number from a major prime. What's in it are, you know, not to joke with Tom Hanks and Sony guts, but it's like, well, wait a minute, it might have Huawei guts in it.
No, 100%. I agree with that. You know, not biased. I do think this, you and I have talked about this. I got a son headed out to a DDG and a destroyer out in Yokosuka. I care that, you know, these systems are going to function properly in wartime. And I think we need to really illuminate our supply chains. We need to figure out who's put what where and mitigate against that. You can't replace all of it, but you can run software that looks for anomalous activity, that looks for non-standard, you know, architecture, and you can preserve your right and then understand, hey, in wartime, I'm not going to get any spares because you will not be getting spares from your secondary tertiary suppliers in China in the middle of the crisis. So, you know, I would just like transparency and understanding, and then you can build a prioritization and mitigation plan. And I think we have to do that. And this is no administration's fault. This stretches across 4 or 5 administrations of just, you know, probably taking the lowest bidder. You know, when and that's how we got in this, like you described perfectly, this kind of H-bomb and S-bomb mess.
Let's go into a little bit of a lightning round now. Just real quickly on supply chains, right? I mean, we've been talking about vulnerability of supply chains, and you just even mentioned, you know, one of them. Are you happy with the level of effort on the cyber supply chain? Both elements of it, right? The supply chain in general, the cyber supply chain, and whether we're making progress on, or making progress as quickly as we need to on both these fronts.
So I'm excited about the improvement and the understanding of a problem. In other words, if you were to go back 3 years ago, particularly pre-COVID, but then even, you know, pre the Cyberspace Learning Commission, this just was, if it was understood, it was understood by a handful of people who didn't have the, you know, the network, you know, the voice to the platform to like call attention to it. It's now an understood problem. And what I think I'm probably, not surprisingly, when you have a very expensive problem evidence itself and no other problem goes away, so it's going to take new money to fix it, it's hard. And so what I'd say is, well, I'm impressed with the transparency and the understanding of the problem. I'm not so excited about our ability to, you know, scope it, prioritize it, and fix it.
Let me take you to Iran. Are we seeing an uptick in Iranian cyber activity, and how is it we've got to regard them? Right, in this conversation, we spent some time talking about Russia and China, two adversaries that are known. North Korea is seen as sort of the ransomware thug in this equation. What about the Iranians, and are you seeing, and are we seeing any more heightened activity in the wake of everything that's been going on in the Middle East?
Yeah, So historic, like if I were to look back 2 years or traditionally in a steady state, the Iranian cyber program is first and foremost about suppressing internal dissent and suppressing expats, you know, cyber wise. Right. Then the third element of it was usually unsuccessful attacks on the Israeli critical infrastructures. Right. That was where they're kind of, and the level of efforts were pretty high on the first two. What we've seen change since October 7th is much more trying to be involved in both some attacks on Israeli critical infrastructure, but a little bit on U.S. critical infrastructure, very limited, but also doing influence operations, right? Trying to make Al-Qassim and other groups look more powerful than they are. So, in fact, we found the Iranians on numerous occasions masquerading as IRGC proxies, you know, Hamas proxies, things like that, to look like they're those groups doing things. And even, and these are minor things like website to Facebook, things like that, but showing power there, right? So yes, they're doing more. I don't know that they're impacting more, but they're doing more. And I'm sure they're still crushing internal dissent. I haven't looked at that recently, but I'll put that in the persistent, you know, message, persistent mission for them. So a little bit more externally and a little bit more, you know, kind of like undercover of looking like they're a proxy group.
Let me just, I want to get your view because you are a distinguished former surface warfare officer and, you know, commanded ships that were expert at shooting down things of the likes that was downed in what was, I think, an incredible operation to defend Israel from more than 300 ballistic crews, as well as explosive drones. But I want to quickly go to the disinformation point. So this is an issue you and I have been talking about for many years. And the U.S. government has been trying to understand what are ways to counter and fight disinformation that go beyond mere sort of educating the public, right? We're finding, the highly thoughtful chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Turner, the Republican from Ohio, is calling out his own caucus for, you know, augmenting and becoming vessels for Russian propaganda. We had Marjorie Taylor Greene repeating the Russian trope that the Ukrainians are Nazis and we shouldn't be helping Ukrainian Nazis, even though that's completely absurdist. And the president of Ukraine, duly elected, is a Jewish Ukrainian, as if that even matters, right? Walk us through the disinformation battle and how we need to trim sails, because now it's being contorted as a free speech battle. And there's a lot of nuance here. And I know folks in government and folks like you who think about this are thinking about this in a nuanced way. How do you counter this? Because almost everybody who stands up and says, hey, wait a minute, don't do this, actually ends up getting voted off the GOP island, right? I mean, so it's not like this is, you know, even though I think Mike Turner does come from a district where he is seen as a valued member and likely and has a safe seat. How do we do this ultimately, Mark?
So first of all, I think you're absolutely right. And we have to call it, I think the right term, one of the things we first need to do when reporting all this disinformation to keep it out of politics is put the word foreign in front of it. The foreign disinformation isn't a question of fact, isn't a question of like, well, you know, is the government trying to be an arbiter of truth? No, our intelligence agencies are telling us these countries are running foreign disinformation campaigns against us. The Chinese do it, the Russians do it. The Iranians and North Koreans do it in a way that really doesn't impact us. But those first two are big, very big. And here at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, we actually started up a team that's looking at very much, you know, the use of bot networks and other tools to kind of amplify false stories. Well, we contributed to the Spamouflage piece that was in the New York Times with a report kind of showing Chinese use of it. We found Russian bot networks in a report we put out. And now we're taking a look very specifically at how different countries have tried to impact our elections and kind of just to show so that the secretaries of state have an understanding. These are the three or four tools you'll see and most likely in your type of state, because we have to attack this. And look, I put the word foreign in front of it. We had no trouble in our bipartisan Cyberspace Solidarity Commission, both in the basic report itself and in a white paper we did on disinformation, highlighting these, but it's you do it by highlighting the foreign part of it. I'm not going to try to decide what some congressman said in Pennsylvania about, you know, water supplies is true or not true, or the budget is true or not true. But I am going to get involved when RT and Sputnik are putting out statements, and then they're being, you know, amplified as facts, which they're not. That's what we have to kill. So I'm glad you're tackling this issue. We absolutely have to do it. I would, if I put the word foreign in front of it and you don't like it, then the problem's with you.
Spoken like somebody who spent a little bit of time on the Hill trying to push long, wet noodles, soft noodles up a pole. I don't know what analogy I'm trying to use, but anyway, I think you get it. Even though what I think is toxic is the leaders themselves should know better, and they do know better. And ultimately, if a leader repeats something, right, others who are less informed are going to say, well, you know, she's saying it, so it must be true, so I can repeat it. And that's where I think the whole thing gets problematic. But hey, we're in a neo shameless era, so it doesn't matter. Let me take you to the defense of Israel over the weekend. About 120 ballistic missiles, 30, 40 cruise missiles, about 120 explosive drones, an extraordinary coalition, Israel, United States, UK, France, Jordan, other nations that were participating in this in one fashion or another. One person, unfortunately, one young girl was injured on the ground, and her status is a little bit unclear. Unfortunately, this was a command and control achievement. It was an integration achievement. Walk us through what stood out as somebody who's, you know, done this, whether on a ship, has tried to do this as a fleet, and then in coalition operations in the Indo-Pacific. And a quick word, Dr. Tom Carrico of the Missile Defense Project from the Center for Strategic and International Studies is going to be on the Air Power podcast focusing on this issue tomorrow. But I wanted to get your sense as sort of a career-long operator on what jumped out at you.
Well, thanks. And I look forward to listening to Tom's opinion. I respect him. First, this was a very impressive effort by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and particularly the U.S. Air Force and U.S. Navy, but also with some kick-in contributions from the U.S. Army and the British Air Force, U.K. Air Force. The first thing you learn from it is defense in depth matters. Having multiple layers matters. It was kind of really beneficial to have those U.S. F-15s thin the herd of drones and cruise missiles. So the IDF, and that was really over Iraq for the most part. And then the IDF could clean them up over Jordan, you know, with their F-35s and F-16s. A second big lesson for us that we should have learned is our adversaries, you know, Russia and Ukraine, Iran in the Middle East, I think China as well, are becoming heavily reliant on cruise missiles and ballistic missiles. So we better buy ourselves some defense in depth, right? If we're gonna deal with these things. The third thing I thought was important, this story will have to come out, but Israel is one of the only countries in the world that operates aerostats for air defense, that is dirigibles. In fact, it's the U.S. paid for it. Missile Defense Agency did a lot of the payment. It's a U.S. drone company or aerostat company, and it's an Israeli radar, but it could be a U.S. radar. I think that gives them unbelievable situational awareness. And we need to be thinking, don't we need dirigibles or aerostats over Ramstein and in Europe, you know, our big air base, or our big air base in Guam and in Japan. The next one I'll tell you is it was great use of the U.S.-Israeli upper tier coordination. That's where we coordinate between Aero and Aegis to do the ballistic missile defense. That's something Admiral Stavridis, you know, had a couple other guys start a dozen years ago, and it's come to full fruition. They worked great, and you had the first combat test of the SM-3 successfully. Final lesson, it's for the Republicans to hear and the administration in Ukraine. F-16s in Ukraine would have a absolute game-changing impact on air defense. They can thin that same herd, and that's necessary in the cruise missiles, but also somewhat in the drones, because they're down to very few of their air defense missiles, AMRAAMs and Patriots and other systems. So they need these F-16s. So we need the supplemental package, but also the administration is not acting with alacrity, with speed and agility on getting the F-16s there. We need to push that hard. They obviously need the support from the Congress of the $60 billion Ukraine assistance bill. If we can have those two things, that's one more tool in President Zelensky's kit as he pushes back on the illegal invasion by Vladimir Putin. A lot of great lessons, Bago.
Mark, always a pleasure having you on the program. Truly is. Keep up the great work and look forward to having you back on again soon. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Bago. It was a real pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. We'll be back again tomorrow with the Air Power Podcast with my co-host, J.J. Gertler. And our guest is going to be Dr. Tom Carrico of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, delving into the details of air and missile defense, not just over Israel, as we saw over the weekend, but also talk to us a little bit about how Ukraine is doing at a very dire moment as Washington continues to dither over aid. Until then, I hope everybody has a great day, and we'll see you again tomorrow. Thanks very much.